Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The definition of who is homeless in Columbus is always changing. According to the Community Shelter Board, the number of homeless families in Columbus has risen drastically by 65% over the past 3 years. There's a new shelter going up next spring, but in the short run, the Community Shelter Board has asked local churches for help. Joining us to explain what the increase means for the Columbus community and how they plan to cope with the changes is Michelle Heritage, Executive Director of the Community Shelter Board. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So, you know, I guess the demographics and the numbers of people who are homeless are changing. Can you give us a thumbnail on how they're changing and why, if we know?
Sure. We are really seeing more families than ever becoming homeless in our community. As you said, that statistic over the last 3 years, we've got a 65% increase in the number of families experiencing homelessness. This really has to do with several factors, including that lingering recession, trying to find living wage work, and also trying to find affordable housing. We are seeing some increases in the number of folks who are very young that are becoming homeless, especially in our family system.
Versus very young, not children, but young adults, you mean?
We see some increase in those young adults under the age of 30 that are experiencing homelessness. We have seen this kind of thing happen before in a trend back in the late 80s when you had a back-to-back recession. Mm-hmm. Same kind of thing. It's very difficult to get into employment and, again, find one that's a living wage and allows you to pay for a place to live. And in our family system, we really have very young moms. They're usually under the age of 27, and they've got two little kids with them under the age of 7.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm talking with Michelle Heritage. She's the executive director of the Community Shelter Board. We're talking about changing trends in homelessness. I guess you're a model agency. People around the country look to you. But what you have to be better at than anything is just managing change.
Absolutely. Really what you see happening lately is, again, those continued impacts from the recession. People who may have been barely hanging on have worked through all the resources they've got. Folks that are coming to us are really not coming out of being directly evicted or foreclosed on. They're actually coming from being doubled up with friends and family. And they've moved through and all of those have been used up, all those resources, and they're coming to us. We've also seen an increase in this community, specifically among women becoming homeless. Now, I know you're going to ask me why, and I can't answer that question yet. We're not sure why women, specifically single women, are becoming homeless at a higher rate than we've seen in the past.
But that does change what your role is.
Absolutely, it does. I think one of the things we really have to work on, and it's one of the reasons that Community Shelter Board is a national model, is really thinking of things systemically. In other words, what are we doing to prevent people from becoming homeless? What are we doing to help them get into other resources besides having to come to shelter? Have we right-sized the shelter system so there's enough beds that nobody should be on the street? How fast can we move people through? How long can we, how can we get them housed at a very high rate? And then how do we stop them from coming back over and over again?
I referred to the plan to get the churches involved in overnight housing. I remember a similar network of church organizations helping in this way a few years ago, about 5 years ago, I guess. Why did that end? Mm-hmm. And Is that what you're just starting that up again?
You're referring to the Interfaith Hospitality Network. This was a large network of congregations that used to shelter overnight families. Families would go there and they'd sleep at the churches overnight. Churches would provide some services like showers and transportation and food and these kinds of things. And then they would go back to a center during the day. That ended when the Family Center got built about 7 years ago. That's the YWCA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the Family Center got built about 7 years ago with room for 50 families, thinking that that was adequate. In fact, thinking that was more than adequate. And what we found through time is that more families have become homeless than we ever anticipated. Again, not predicting, you know, what was going to happen in 2008 with recession and all of those impacts. And now what we find is we're averaging closer to 110, 115 families that need shelter every night.
That's that 65% increase.
That's exactly right. So what we've done is we have a long-term solution which we can turn on next spring, which is the new building. There's a new building that will have several different kinds of things operating inside of it. And one of those things will include extra beds for families. And so in the meantime, we've asked the churches to activate for us very quickly to help us so that we can relieve overcrowding at the family center.
What's the response been?
The response has been excellent so far. You know, what's incredible about Columbus is we have this faith community that is standing at the ready all the time to be asked. And so what we find is there's an excitement about trying to get involved and saying, yes, we want to help. And in fact, we have a large faith-based group that's been working on the single adult issue as we've been building out this new system for single adults that's a completely different way of doing business. The faith community has been there with us, and we've actually built them into the model. Instead of thinking about them as an afterthought, we're really building them into the model because people of faith, no matter what your faith is, there's something that's said about the least and the less and how we should be managing the least and the less among us, no matter what your faith.
So what happened that they that network dissolved after a time?
Well, we really didn't need to use that strategy anymore. It's very difficult for a family to have to transport, you know, to a church and or a synagogue or whatever faith community, stay there overnight, get up very early in the morning, and then have to transfer back into, you know, where they're going to be during the day. What we wanted was a center where the services would be provided at the same place that people were going to be sleeping so that we weren't having to transfer back and forth all the time. So the building of the YWCA Family Center actually alleviated the need for it.
But now there's an overflow.
Absolutely.
The need returns. So you hope that the need will go away again. But you're saying what you want to do is build the faith community into the system more so that it's not this ad hoc experience every
Absolutely.
Few years.
I think the key is we don't know what the new normal is. None of us expect it. No one, no matter where you worked, whether you were a banker or a lawyer or a social worker or anybody, none of us ever expected what was going to happen with the Great Recession. It took everybody and said, wow, here's how bad it can get for a lot of folks. And so what we know is that we can build additional beds that can handle overflow capacity. But what we don't know is if that's going to be the new normal going forward. Are we going to go back down to numbers that we had, you know, 6 and 7 years ago? Or are these numbers going to be the new that we need to serve? The key is getting great results. One of the things Community Shelter Board is focused on, intently focused on, is getting good outcomes. So here's what's great about a system that's well-built and why it's a national model. Even with an onslaught of families that need these services, we still continue to house families at a very high rate. They move through very quickly. And by quickly, I mean in about 20 days versus the national average of 74 days. And they rarely return to becoming homeless again. And so we're really focused on, we may be serving more people, but we need to do a really great job of ending their homelessness quickly and making sure they don't come back to being homeless again. And we've been able to do that even with the increased numbers.
We were talking about this earlier before we went on the air that because Columbus is a national model and it's so successful, a lot of times people who live here a long time, like I have since 1989, don't know. And of course, when I travel around, I don't necessarily go to places where the homeless are going to be. So I don't know. There are some cities that don't have really any kind of organized agency or anything.
I would say the Community Shelter Board model is the not norm. And in fact, one of the things that a lot of our national partners are looking to is how do you form a community shelter board, which now is the new buzzword, a collective impact organization, where everyone is working together in tandem. We all agree on the same goals. We're working in the same direction. The funding is focused. And we're really, really concerned about achieving an outcome, that we really want to make sure that we're achieving certain things, benchmarking for the whole community. And that really across the country does not exist very often. There's also many communities that don't have good resources, and even ones that do. I just last week was with my colleague from Los Angeles, who runs a Los Angeles homeless system, and they have enough beds for only 20% of the people experiencing homelessness in Los Angeles. So the street population in Los Angeles is as big as Lancaster, Ohio. if you think about that, even in a city like Los Angeles.
Compare that to Columbus. What percentage do you have beds for?
Well, right now we do not have enough beds for our single adults. And that's why we have embarked on for the last 2 years a transformative process in which we will have a new model to make sure that we are able to have enough beds for all of our single adults. There's been times during this last couple years where we've had waiting lists for our single adult system, sometimes as many as 100, 125 people. And we've been especially concerned about our women that may have to wait a week or 2 weeks to get in. When we turn this new model on, which will be in the spring, beginning to get that implemented, we will make sure that we have flexible capacity year-round and that anyone that needs a bed is able to get it. In the family system, we made that commitment as a community 7 years ago when the family center got built that no family would ever be street homeless.
I want to get to the system that you're going to start up in the spring, but before we do, I wanted to understand why there are so many discrepancies in the number, the numbers of homeless, or at least what national and state and local agencies say there are. The National Alliance to End Homelessness last summer estimated that the number of homeless people had declined 17% from 2005 to 2012. What's the deal with that?
Absolutely. Here's the great news of the day, which is Columbus has been, you know, since the shelter board was formed in 1986, we've been on this march to decrease and ultimately end homelessness. But many communities across the nation have not. Many communities across the nation haven't had services. They haven't had any organized fashion in going about how they're delivering services. And the federal government, not too long ago, said, we think it's so important that we have a concerted strategy about how we're going to end homelessness that they put together the opening door strategy. That was the first time that the federal government said, here is how we as a nation are going to end homelessness. Here are specific targets. Here are specific techniques. Here are specific strategies that we're going to move on. And so that's a great number because that means that our colleagues all across the country have begun to implement strategies to reduce homelessness significantly. And I think what's interesting is the United States Interagency Council, who put the Opening Doors National Plan together, is headed by Barb Poppy, who ran the shelter board for 15 years.
Right. And we'll be hearing from the policy director for the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness later on in the program. Coming up, we're going to hear from Andrew Roberts. He's the president of the YMCA of Central Ohio, and he's going to talk about that new shelter that's going to be opening up in the spring. And we'll take your questions and comments. 614-292-8513. Is the number to call. If you have a question, email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. There has been a 14% increase in the number of homeless single men and women in Central Ohio and a 65% increase in the number of families seeking shelter over the last 3 years. The Community Shelter Board plans to open a new shelter to accommodate the demand in the spring. We've been talking about that with Michelle Heritage, Executive Director of the Community Shelter Board. Joining us now is Andrew Roberts, President of the YMCA of Central Ohio. They're one of the agencies or one of the organizations that is taking this new shelter in hand. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
So let's go back a little bit with YMCA in general and talk about, because I know the YWCA is involved with it as well, but what about the YMCA's involvement with sheltering the homeless? Is there a history there?
Oh, there's a long and deep history. 160 years ago, the YMCA was housing young men that came to the city to participate in the Industrial Revolution from the country. And so it's really always been in our DNA to be a preventative kind of organization. And at the end of the day, the Y is a human potential organization. And we're just the kind of people that don't believe that anybody should have to be outside at night if they want a bed. So you're absolutely apt and correct in that we are one of many providers working in a systemic approach, and we just happen to be focused at the YMCA of Central Ohio on the single adult population.
Okay, so the new shelter that opens up in the spring, Michelle Heritage, you said that it's multifaceted.
Uh-huh.
So does that mean the YMCA is taking ownership of one of those facets? Is that what you're saying, Andrew?
It's a multidimensional approach, and mm-hmm. there will be different populations in there and different activities. I think it's okay to think of the YMCA as kind of the front door shelter operator, and we've typically, for the last few years, when asked by the Community Shelter Board, run the overflow shelter situation during the winter months, especially mm-hmm. when it gets cold. So it's more just flexing up and flexing down. Instead of doing that seasonally, we'll be doing that all year long. And Michelle can speak to the case management aspect and some of the other activities that will be going on there. But think of us as the operator of the front door shelter.
Where is it going to be located, Michelle?
Yeah, this is a building that's located in the West Edge Business Center. It's on Van Buren Drive. So if you think about where the old Cooper Stadium is, okay. now the racetrack, there's a little place there kind of bounded by Harmon Road, and it's on a little street called Van Buren. It's quite ideal because it's very close to services for folks to be able to get into the city. It's on transportation. It is on 5 acres, though, and so it does allow some buffering between us and our neighbors. And it's not in a heavily residential area so that we don't have too many concerns from a heavy residential area. Although I always point out that, you know, two of our largest shelters are right down in the Discovery District and have been there for many years and functioning well with the neighbors and businesses there. This building is large enough to accommodate several things, so it's killing several birds with one stone. One of the things it's doing, as Xander referred to, is this new front door shelter. What we found is about 40% of men and women who come to us leave by about day 7. They really get that out there on their own. They just need a very short stay. They don't need heavy-duty intensive services. They just need to be able to get some resources they can get out. I try to think of this as kind of the Kroger self-service checkout when you're going through. Mm. You beep your own groceries through. If you get stuck, there's always that lady there.
I always do.
We do.
Okay.
And she's got her machine, and she makes your thing go again. Same thing. Folks will have resource rooms where they can get to employment and find places to live. But we really don't want to provide heavy-duty services for folks that can get out on their own, because that means that 60% of the folks that are coming in either come back repeatedly or have such significant challenges they do need to be linked immediately and have some services, case management, and those kinds of things. This also lets us add some additional beds to the system. For single adults, we have not added any beds since 2001. Our community has grown significantly since then, and we've also had an increase in homelessness. So we wanted to right-size the system with this redesign. As Andrew referred to, we're going to have flexible capacity year-round. So not just during the winter, but whenever we have an overflow happen, we will have the beds there to do that, and the Y will staff those.
Will it be flexible within itself? In other words, if you have a downturn in one population, you'll be able to use beds from that?
Absolutely.
Kind of move the walls sort
absolutely.
Of a thing?
Absolutely. And as we refer to, the YWCA will be helping us with additional beds that we'll need for families. We suspect 20 to 40 additional beds. And again, that's overflow in the family center. So the Y, you'd normally be at the family center, but if we go over their capacity, we'll be needing to flex into those beds. And then we want to replace one of our women's shelters called Rebecca's Place. This is a place that has been going for some time. It's 47 women. It's a longer-term shelter for women with multiple barriers, but it's in a very dilapidated, outdated building. It's in these three old apartment buildings. This has been a lease, and the apartment buildings went into foreclosure. They went into receivership. Just really a terrible situation for our provider. So Southeast Incorporated, which is the provider of Rebecca's Place, will also move in. So you really have four
different
things.
They're going to move out of their old place, mm-hmm. and this will be their permanent Rebecca's
Place. It will be their
place.
New permanent place to be.
So what's it like, Andrew, bringing all that together and being at the front door? You're going to have to meet a lot of different kinds of people.
Yeah, that's really our core competency at the Y, is meeting people where they're at in a humane kind of way. You asked before about some of the historical context. I think it's interesting to think of this in terms of the deinstitutionalization that happened in the mental health system and the mm-hmm. closing of the state hospitals. And if you think about YMCAs that had all across this country, you know, downtown at the YMCA today, we still take care of 403 men that are sort of at the edge, maybe comorbid mental health, some addiction issues going on. Those folks typically would have been in a state hospital setting or something like that. And so when you think about it from a policy perspective, we closed all these institutions. We were supposed to support them in the communities, and then as funding got tighter and tighter, those things dried up. And so when you think about the supply of people experiencing homelessness, you look to the mental health system, and you look to the criminal justice system, and you look to some of these other systems that end up you know, being the folks that are at our front doors.
That brings up a question about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and what your expectations are for what sort of impact that might have on the system as a whole, with more people covered by Medicaid, for one thing, in Ohio, now that that's passed through the controlling board at the legislature. What kind of difference might that make, Michelle?
It's an excellent development. I believe what's going to happen there is that people who have been unable to get the kinds of services that Andrew just talked about.
Yeah.
So, you know, but for the fact that they may have a problem with substance use, but for the fact that they have an untreated mental health condition, that they end up in a position of homelessness, and they may end up staying in a position of homelessness for very long periods of time because they are untreated. I think the potential for individuals to get the kinds of services that may prevent their homelessness or end it very quickly is going to really be part of what this Affordable Care Act brings to the table. It also, I believe, might free up dollars that we're spending on those services now.
In the free clinics and so forth?
That we could use for other kinds of services that would also work in both preventative natures and also moving people through quickly. We also find that people who experience long-term homelessness are usually very physically ill. So the average rate, the death age on average for someone with long-term homelessness is 62 years old. 62 years old. It's like 15 years before the rest of us. And that's because they have conditions that are, diabetes and cardiac conditions and respiratory.
And if there's mental health issues, it's 25 years.
Yes.
I think it's even longer.
Yes, exactly. And so we find in our single adult system, 46% of the folks are identifying that they have a disability, sometimes, as Andrew said, comorbid, several disabilities at once. So when we think about to the community, so this is definitely going to help folks experiencing homelessness. When we think about to the community of folks not using high-cost services like emergency departments and also getting treatment for things like treating their diabetes on the front end where it can be managed instead of having to have lose their sight or end up blind or have amputations because of their diabetes because it's been untreated for so long, the cost savings to the community as a whole is just going to be, I think, astronomical.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Michelle Heritage of the Community Shelter Board and also Andrew Roberts of the YMCA of Central Ohio. We're talking about homelessness. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. Have you benefited from the Community Shelter Board services in Central Ohio? Give us a call and tell us how it's affected your life, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You described why you chose this location for the new shelter, but it still seems sort of out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And there were criticisms, I'm trying to think of like 5 or 6 years ago, that the new shelter by the Fairgrounds,
yeah,
was off the, you know, out of the way, mm-hmm. and there wasn't a connection between where the services had been, given and where they were going. How do you connect the dots for people?
Yeah, this location, it may seem out of the way, but it's really quite ideal when you think about being able to travel on a bus, for example. You know, the number 3 runs 36 times a day past that site. Even on the weekends, it's running all the time. And so it's very, very close to some other services, including, I know we have another shelter that's out there very closely. Life Care Alliance is out there. Children's Services.
The Mid-Ohio Food Bank.
Yep. The Mid-Ohio Food Bank is, you know,
right.
Out in Grove City now.
That's right.
But it really was, that was for one of the things we really looked at, which was, did we have a large enough building? Was it zoned appropriately? Was it sprinkled? Was it in an area in which we felt that there hadn't been too much of a concentration of these kinds of services, but enough? It's a really, really delicate balance. And we've been doing the community process now. We had our first series of community meetings, 2 with our business folks out there and 2 with the residents. And we've really been getting a lot of positive feedback. Folks are asking the right kind of questions about safety and, management of folks and what will occur in the building. But what's been really incredible is several of the residents, including some of the congregations and the businessmen, have reached out to us and said, what can we do? How can we help? You know, we do these cleanup drives here, you know, twice a year. Do you think you could have your folks, you know, in the shelter, would they be willing to do the neighborhood cleanup with all the residents? And it's just, frankly, the response back from this community on the west side has been just overwhelmingly positive to doing this. I think many folks realize that it's so needed. The thing that's a sea change for us in this is that this community is now committing that no man or woman that needs shelter should go without shelter. This is a new thing for this community. We have in the past had a fixed capacity system for single adults, which means when the last bed is full, we put people on wait lists, which is a really nice word for we put people on the street. And, you know, when Community Shelter Board went out to the community 2 years ago and said, are we ready as a community to say that this is not how Columbus does things, that we are so much better than this and so much more able to do things? We've already got the national model for families. Let's do it for singles. And this, and the community said yes. Our elected officials said yes. Our corporate community said yes. And our individuals and our faith community said yes.
So you're taking a warehouse. Andrew Roberts, how do you turn a warehouse into home?
Carefully and flexibly.
Like I said, lots of moving walls.
You know, I think it's important to note, you know, in as evidenced by the family system and what we'll try to achieve in the new spaces, you know, this is about a hand up, not a hand out. So we want it to be decent and humane, but we're trying to get people housed. The whole point of this entire exercise is to get people out of a state of homelessness and into some sort of supportive housing environment where they can feel free to pursue their potential. And so the point of this is not to make it so comfortable or to have TVs or to have people just staying there. The point of this and the whole reason we're doing the case management and the whole reason we're having the front door so that we can apply most efficiently the right resource to the right set of problems that somebody is having is so that we can get them housed. And that's the only way we'll ever achieve our big, hairy, audacious goal of ending homelessness is to get people housed. And so we want to see homelessness as a temporary state. We want to reduce the length of stay of that temporary state. And so bring it to bear, whether it's the mental health stuff or the job stuff or, you know, whatever the resources are for that particular person, mm-hmm. we're trying to match the need with the resource.
I know that it depends on whether you're what you're talking about in terms of the mix of populations that you'll have in there at any one time, but what's the maximum that it's going to be able to house in a night?
So we'll have about 65 on the front door. So that's that entry shelter for first timers.
Okay.
47 in Rebecca's Place. About
Rebecca's Place is just for women?
Just women. It's one of our two women shelters in town. We have Rebecca's Place and Nancy's Place.
Okay.
And so Rebecca's will be coming in under this new roof. And there's about 47 women in there. And then we will have 20 to 40 beds for the family center for families. And those families vary in size. And so it's hard to say.
Right.
Our average family has 3 people in it. But some of our families are very large and some are much smaller.
And the way it's situated is the family gets their own private quarters. And no. Okay.
Yeah, we won't do that here. We're really going to be using this not so much as a building out a new family center with all the great bells and whistles that our family center has, including on-site daycare and the Columbus City Schools on-site and all that.
At the YWCA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is just our gold standard of really how to serve families. We're really looking at this as kind of a safety valve, meaning the families would be overnight there and they'd go back to the family center for the work that they need to do to end their homelessness.
Would you have the food and feeding and, mm-hmm. and so forth, would that mm-hmm. be all one facility then that can serve all the different
yeah.
areas?
We will actually have one large kitchen. The kitchen will be built out large enough for volunteers because many, many volunteer groups want to come in and serve meals and cook meals. Mm-hmm. So a big commercial kitchen and then separate dining rooms for the different populations.
Okay.
Same thing, you know, shower facilities all separated for all the different populations, spaces separated for the different folks.
So many organizations are involved in the opening of the new shelter. How is it going to be managed when several different organizations are involved? Andrew, how does that work that way?
You know, I think Columbus is unique, and I'm relatively new here myself, having moved here from Connecticut a couple of years ago, and I've just been so struck by how collaborative a community Columbus is. And especially, you know, we talked a little bit before about this notion of collective impact. The community shelter board's role in this community is to herd all of the individual providers, well-meaning as we are, like the YMCA, into a unified strategy that is efficient and effective and meets the needs of our community. And so we've all become very well practiced at working together and doing handoffs and just making sure that we're each adding our own unique value add to whatever particular situation it is, but doing so in a humble, helpful, supportive manner, in a way that is consistent with the strategy that we've set as a community.
We have an email from Troy. He writes, I am volunteering in a local shelter and am horrified at what I am seeing in a way I never was before. Now it's not they or them. It's untreated mentally ill patients and people who look like life ran over them. How do we get the faces of these people across so that others are horrified too? I imagine what Troy means is horrified to action.
Yeah.
You Michelle? Know. Or go ahead, Andrew.
There's certainly a stigmatism with the single adult population. I think this community, and it's easy to raise money for and provide for families and small children. But I think what Troy is talking about is really the issue that we talked about before, just in terms of, you know, a lot of the addiction issues we see are people self-treating their mental illness and to a point where they now have two life-threatening diseases. And so you just see folks in such a way that is really, I think empathy is required from anybody who's doing this work and seeing people, you know, as other human beings who are really, really experiencing problems, sometimes not their own. I think sometimes the stigmatism, there's a moral issue where people think people are layabouts that might have a choice in this matter. But we're really talking about a form of illness.
An email from Amy wanted to know what the most common issues are causing homelessness. And, of course, you've addressed the mental health piece of that, substance abuse and how it's related to mental health as well, among the single male population especially. Do those same issues carry over to the families, or does that tend to be more economic, recession, homelessness because, you know, the mortgage meltdown and that sort of thing?
Yes, it does carry over. Here's what I see is that there is more diversity of function in the single adult system, meaning there are folks that come in, they're very short-term stayers, they may have been laid off, they're moving through. There's some folks that come in that have had what we'll call multiple barriers and they're very challenged. Maybe they have don't have a great work history. If they've had a conviction of any kind, I'm here to tell you, and Andrew can back me up, that's like a death sentence about trying to find a job.
Right.
And so you've kind of almost been doomed to poverty, even if you paid your debt, even though it was 10 years ago, maybe. You really have a hard time finding a job, especially a living wage job. So we've got folks with those multiple barriers to help them. And then we have folks that have very significant challenges, severe disabilities, really insane, or not insane, but intense mental health, and really incredible substance use, which, as Andrew said, starts to go hand in hand. You know, what came first? Are you self-medicating? And now you've got two life-threatening diseases. In the family system, you don't see that very broad diversity because you have to be at a certain functioning level to have your children.
Okay.
Which means you may have some challenging mental health problems. You may be using substances. But I will tell you, just because you're a single adult in our system doesn't mean you don't have children. It may mean that you have had children, but you don't currently have custody of them.
Okay.
So I think we see a much broader range of the functioning that people are experiencing in the single adult system.
In the family system, I don't mean to interrupt you, Andrew, but before we have to take a quick break too. But in the family system, is it just mothers and children, or can it be mothers and fathers, or fathers and children, and whatever iteration?
We don't define the family. So
okay.
It's how that family, what we need to have is an adult with custody of a person that's under the age of 18. And then if they have others that they're bringing with them that they are, you know, have a relationship with somehow.
I was just going to say, on the single adult and the family side, family violence and violence against women, human trafficking, all those are also big reasons why people show up in
Absolutely.
The system.
Absolutely, yeah.
Trying to make a big change.
We see quite a bit of domestic violence in our family system, people fleeing, and we suspect that's one of the things happening in our single women system is fleeing domestic violence.
We have to take a quick break. My guests, Andrew Roberts of the YMCA of Central Ohio, Michelle Heritage of the Community Shelter Board. Coming up, we'll hear from the policy director for the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The state of homelessness in the United States is a moving target. Who is homeless, why they're homeless, and where they are homeless all come into play. And the issues differ from state to state. The United States Interagency Council on Homelessness coordinates the various agencies that work on issues related to homelessness at the federal level. Still with us, Michelle Heritage of the Community Shelter Board and also Andrew Roberts of the YMCA of Central Ohio. Joining us now by phone from Washington is Richard Cho. He's the policy director for the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness. Welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Richard, I mentioned earlier in the program that the National Alliance to End Homelessness estimates a 17% decrease in the total number of homeless over the past 5 years, but locally the numbers are way up. How do your numbers stack up to those?
Well, the National Alliance to End Homelessness, as the national advocacy organization, tends to use the same numbers that we do, which essentially come from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and they actually aggregate the numbers across the country. That largely come from one measure of homelessness, which is the point-in-time count, which is basically a snapshot of what homelessness looks like on a single night in America, typically takes place in the month of January. So their numbers largely match with what the United States Interagency Council uses.
In the past few years, how have the homelessness rates been changing nationally?
So the over the past few years, we've seen kind of steady amounts of homelessness overall in terms of the number of people experiencing homelessness. The numbers that we're working with right now still come from the year 2012 point-in-time count and essentially shows that there's about 630,000 people experiencing homelessness on any given night. That's largely remained stable. Within that group, though, we've seen some changes in who's actually increasing in the rates of homelessness and who's actually decreasing. The biggest decreases are among people who are veterans who are experiencing homelessness, as well as people experiencing chronic homelessness, who tend to be people who have higher rates of mental health and substance use problems. We're actually seeing steady levels and maybe even slight increases among people, persons and families who are experiencing homelessness.
For the folks the categories where you're seeing the decreases, what do you attribute those decreases to?
I think that's one area where you can really attribute the decreases to what's happened both at the federal level as well as at the community level in terms of a real concerted focus to increase resource investment for the kind of housing and services models that we've seen over the past few years to really have a lot of evidence for permanently ending homelessness among people and as well as improving their health and behavioral health conditions, that specifically investments in permanent supportive housing. Over the past few years, the administration's really increased resources for a program known as HUD-VASH, which pairs rental assistance with services for veterans experiencing chronic homelessness, and recently have invested in a new prevention program known as the Supportive Services for Veteran Families program, which provides both short-term financial assistance coupled with some case management to help veterans who are newly homeless to really become rehoused.
What is the evidence that those programs, that they're working on a long-term basis? Because they're pretty new, aren't they?
They are pretty new. HUD-VASH is somewhat new. The model that HUD-VASH is really based on is a model called permanent supportive housing, and that kind of model has really been around really since the 80s. And over the past couple of decades, there's been a number of studies that have shown that permanent supportive housing really has pretty dramatic effects. People achieve upwards of 85 to 90% housing stability. I think those effects are enduring, not just in the first year, but people really do remain housed with support. We've also seen that those models are associated with improved health and mental health and substance use conditions, as well as decreases in the use of crisis services, such that I think permanent supportive housing models have been found to just about pay for themselves by decreasing people's use of services like emergency rooms, jails, hospitals.
Michelle Heritage, what does that mean in Columbus? What's the permanent
mm-hmm. supportive housing?
Yes, permanent supportive housing. Where is that in Columbus, and how does that work?
So, Community Shelter Board and our partners have been building permanent supportive housing projects all around the community, and they're you've probably driven by them all over and not realized they're in German Village, and they're in Bexley, and they're in Grandview. Those are, as Richard said, they are places where folks who have experienced long-term homelessness and usually have disabilities go. They receive the kind of supports they need to keep them stably housed. We've got about 1,500 units of permanent supportive housing in our community right now. We'd like to have about 2,700 units. When we look at the number of people we have experiencing long-term homelessness, that's what we need. To Richard's point, I just want to put a fine point on it. The fact is that as a country, at a national level, we said, for example, that we want to end veteran homelessness. And the Veterans Administration, along with the administration, put out the right kinds of resources using proven programs and said, let's make this happen. And one of the populations that we've seen decrease in our community is veterans experiencing homelessness because of these kinds of programs.
Richard Cho, tell us about, you're from the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness. What are all the federal agencies that are involved in these kind of issues?
So our council is actually comprised of 19 federal agencies.
Well, don't list them all here now, okay?
Absolutely not, yes. And they're all of equal importance. The ones that are play a leadership role really are the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, Veteran Affairs, Health and Human Services, and Department of Labor and those and Education. Those represent really our council leadership agencies, and all of them play a pretty critical role in our work.
I was going to ask you, Andrew Roberts, when the new shelter opens up in the spring and a vet comes through your door, what do you tell them? What are their options?
Well, the depending upon what their need is, they'll be steered towards the right resources. So there'll be an assessment. We're still working on the logic models and all that kind of stuff of how that's all going to get implemented. But essentially, as I mentioned before, we've been working with folks. And so the first thing to do is to find out what's going on in their lives. And, you know, sometimes it's rental assistance. Sometimes it's some of this violent stuff going on. Sometimes it's mental health and addiction. And so our job at the front door will be to offer a safe, humane landing spot for somebody so that we can begin to find out what's going on and then figure out what resources that they need.
Usually, and just our coordinated point of access, which is a place that you call if you are imminently going to be homeless or literally are homeless, they do a screening. And if they find out that you're a vet, they will immediately link you to our Veterans Administration here. We've got a very strong partnership with them. We've enjoyed a very good relationship for years with our local VA. And they will actually send a team out. If someone's on the street, they'll send a team out to get with those folks. They'll find those veterans and get them linked with services. And so they're very active. And they've told us, as soon as you come across a vet that says, hey, I'm a veteran and I'm experiencing homelessness, the VA will activate here in Columbus to try to take care of that vet.
Joe in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Oh, thank you.
What's your question?
Yes, excellent program. I wanted to ask a two-part thing. One is how much have they been approaching philanthropic organizations or individuals in Columbus to help with the homeless problem? And I used to volunteer with Open Church, which was absorbed by Faith Mission. I wonder if they're going to still operate, and are they approaching companies also in Columbus to help out with this problem?
All right. Michelle, you did mention that you've been talking to the corporate.
We enjoy in this community a corporate community that I think is like no other in terms of how important they think ending homelessness is. They are heavily invested in ending homelessness. And in fact, one third of the dollars that come in to do this work are private dollars. And over the course of the last 3 years, our private corporate community has increased the amount that they have invested in ending homelessness by 62%.
And then public sources. Richard Cho, could you address that at the federal level? What sort of resources are out there, and how long can they last given
you know, the state of the world in Washington?
Yeah, that's a great question, and obviously there are some challenges affecting those resources today. You know, by far the largest resource available for people experiencing homelessness really comes from HUD, and that's known in a program known as the Continuum of Care. It's roughly just about under $2 billion at this point, and those programs really go to pay for really the essential housing and services models like permanent supportive housing, another model known as rapid rehousing, and other types of interventions that we've known to be effective for communities. Right now, federal agencies are operating under sequester-level funding. There's been cuts to the Continuum of Care program. There's been cuts to some of the other essential federal programs that are have been found to be really needed to help provide both housing and social services for people experiencing homelessness. You know, what we're seeing is a commitment from those federal agencies to make sure that despite the fact that there's budget cuts, that the resources, investments, and that have really, we've seen some steady increases and some more dramatic increases in the case of Department of Veteran Affairs, that those resources are really protected so that the most vulnerable people don't get affected negatively by the sequester. That said, I think we really see the need for continued and new resource investments to really reach our goals of ending homelessness.
You mean at the federal level through the government?
That's correct. In terms of our partnership with philanthropy, obviously we don't have a direct relationship with philanthropy at the federal level, but we encourage the work of our community partners. And I know Community Shelter Board's done a great job of this, of really leveraging philanthropic resources, which really provide some of the more flexible dollars that can be useful in helping create policy changes and move in some new programmatic directions. And a common denominator we see across the country is really where government, philanthropy, and the business community and the nonprofit sector have really collaborated effectively to align their resources and to really increase investments across all sectors.
I know Andrew's mentioned it, and everybody thinks it. Someday we want to end all homelessness. But how do you maintain a program at the federal level like yours with the idea that you're gonna end homelessness? You have to be thinking 5 and 10 years out about how you're going to sustain the services that are out there for the homeless. So it seems a little, I don't know, on one side you want to end it, and the other side you have to be ready to sustain what's out there.
That's right. I think part of the trick of that is making sure that we're using those resources as wisely as possible, and so that when you take some of the most expensive interventions that really cost the most dollars, that those are being targeted at people who need them the most and who have the most intensive service needs. And then for other people experiencing homelessness, the majority of homeless families with children where they don't have a really intensive service needs, the solution may be to really provide just the right level of financial assistance coupled with some short-term services. So I think part of it is about how we match those resources to the right types of people based on their level of need. But I think the other part of it is not looking at just the kind of targeted homeless-specific programs within the federal government, but really looking at how we can start to leverage and tap into some of the mainstream dollars. Mainstream service programs that are operated, say, out of the Health and Human Services Department, and including entitlement programs like Medicaid, which I think is becoming a more important resource for really paying for the kind of services that can be paired with housing. And so where you have the ability to really take a program that's hundreds of billions of dollars and really take some small part of that and make that useful for people experiencing homelessness.
We were talking earlier about how some communities, some states seem better at managing the homelessness problem than others. From where you sit, what's the biggest difference between, say, a Columbus, Ohio, and another city that's of, you know, similar size but is grappling with it?
Yeah, I mean, you heard Michelle earlier refer to the fact that the reason why we're making so much progress on veterans is because there's been a concerted effort, not only at the federal level, but also at the community level, to really set a goal and then to stick to that goal. What you've seen happen in places like Columbus, and I think Columbus is a real leader in this regard, is where you have a number of the community stakeholders and partners decide to align their efforts around that single goal and to stay kind of focused on that goal and to try to find a way to both align and coordinate resources. And one of the biggest problems with addressing homelessness at the community level is often that no one often owns that problem. And so you often have a place where there's really no system to speak of. And so a lot of the work is about how do you create a system out of a number of different organizations who are all working somewhat independently under no particular hierarchy or authority, and how do you get them to sort of work together and collaborate towards that single goal. You've seen that happen in places like Columbus, You're seeing it happen in places like New Orleans, and really is across the country. And other communities, I think, are trying to figure out what's the right way for us to bring all those partners together.
The greatest opportunity for Columbus, now that we have the homelessness system collaborative and coordinated, are the other systems. And so, again, when you think of the criminal justice system or the effect on reimbursement on the healthcare system or the mental health system, if we could rise to that next level where those macro systems are actually coordinated and sharing resources and putting them to their best and most impactful use, then I think we'll really start to address this problem.
And a lot of the issues that are probably the barriers are at the state and federal level.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think there's also, in a city like Columbus, we have the opportunity through the relationships and just the type of community that this is to actually get access to the leaders to solve those problems. And I think actually we're at an advantage because of the size of our cities. We're in even a larger city that might be more difficult.
Well, Andrew Roberts, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Roberts, he's president of the YMCA of Central Ohio. And also Richard Cho, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Richard Cho, he's policy director for the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness. And Michelle Heritage, thanks for joining us again on All Sides.
Anytime.
Michelle is the executive director of the Community Shelter Board. Andrew Zissler produced this show. Thanks to Andrew. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.